For 6 of the 12 years that he was a Labor MP, Robert Tickner was Australia's Minister for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Affairs, first in the Hawke and then the Keating governments. To this day, he's the longest-serving minister in that portfolio. Robert's tenure included challenges like responding to the Royal Commission into Aboriginal deaths in custody, starting the reconciliation process, and also crafting a government response to the Mabo case and the High Court's recognition of native title, and much, much more. After being so close to nationally important issues in turbulent times, 10 years as the CEO of the Australian Red Cross sounds like a walk in the park, but I'm sure it wasn't. But what was the year that made me for Robert Tickner? Let's find out. Robert, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Julian.
Now, obviously, as well as your time in Parliament, before Parliament, you were the Principal Solicitor for the Aboriginal Legal Aid Service in New South Wales and a key member of Friends of the Earth. Where did the desire to deal with social justice issues and Indigenous justice issues in particular come from?
Well, I think that growing up in a country town in New South Wales with Aboriginal classmates, a place called Foster up on the North Coast, you know, I was struck that my own education failed miserably in teaching me anything of use about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australia. My own school textbook in 1967, when I did the school certificate, described Aboriginal people, and I quote, as part of a backward race who are prepared to lie, cheat, and steal. And that's the kind of education that people of
that
my
was in
generation
a, in a
got.
Textbook.
Absolutely. Wow. I hold it to this day. I keep it a reminder of how bad things were. And it explains a lot about the need for Australia to have a just reconciliation.
Mm. In my introduction, I mentioned some of the massive issues you had to deal with in those 6 years as Minister for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Affairs. Let's start with the Royal Commission into Deaths in Custody. Sadly, that remains, you know, a grave issue to this very day. Can you give us your reflections on the Royal Commission, your response to it, and how you sort of see the issue as it's evolved since then?
The first thing to say is that having the responsibility for the national response to that Royal Commission, my objective was to drive the Commonwealth and the states and territories to the strongest level of support possible for the Royal Commission recommendations. And we actually managed to achieve that with Commonwealth support for 338 of the 339 recommendations and a comparable level of state and territory support with, I might say, cross-party support in the various jurisdictions. The problem came after 1996 and the subsequent abolition of ATSIC. Essentially, the heat went out of the issue. The states walked away from their commitments, states and territories. There was no one essentially, holding them accountable at the national level. And the consequence was that we've seen now, over 20 years of a misplaced faith in incarceration, building more and more jails and putting more and more people in jail who really shouldn't be there. And I think there's such a need for us to keep up with the international developments in this area. I mean, even the Republican Party in Texas, in other states of the United States, in the South, the Republicans and the Democrats are actually working together to find alternatives to incarceration. And we've got to do that in Australia, and we've certainly got to make sure that this still vastly disproportionate rate of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander incarceration is ended. And that remains an enormous challenge for that closing the gap strategy.
We'll get to Mabo in a second, but obviously another key controversy during your time as minister was the Hindmarsh Island Bridge affair, and I know the phrase "secret women's business" became part of the national conversation. I was surprised reading back about that affair that the whole political controversy revolved around an inadvertent mailing error. Can you remind us about how that part of the controversy started, and then also give us just your reflections on being at the centre of that very intense issue?
Well, the first thing to say, Julian, is that ultimately, there was only one body which heard evidence on oath from all the parties to that issue and ruled conclusively in the Federal Court of Australia in a judgment of Justice von Dusser to reject the arguments that somehow the Aboriginal women claiming heritage protection had invented those claims. That was refuted, and all the, you know, smears and allegations that were suggesting that somehow I had acted improperly were universally rejected by that federal court decision. But the matter you refer to concerning my mail is a microcosm of what is this enormous area of public debate that's reflected in Margaret Simmons' book, The Meeting of the Waters, and story of this extraordinary affair. But what happened to me was that mail that was directed to me and to my advisor, Sean McLaughlin, were inadvertently delivered to the office of Ian McLaughlin, a front bench member of the opposition team. Unfortunately, my mail was opened. A whole box of it was copied. The copies were scattered, including Commonwealth legal documents, all over Australia to journalists and others. And then, in the House of Representatives, Mr. McLaughlin rose and accused me of mishandling the documents that were entrusted to me, when in fact, you know, I knew nothing about my mail being opened, the box sealed up and sent on to me. The end result of all this was that Mr. McLaughlin resigned from the front bench. But, I mean, that's just a microcosm of the kind of stuff that, you know, I had to deal with in this extraordinary time.
Yes, yeah. Well, look, let's move on to another one of them, Robert Digner. And I must say, if I had to guess the year that made you, 1992 would have been a pretty strong bet. That was the year that your first child was born, and also the year of the Mabo decision, a momentous decision. And it's fair to say, as a Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, probably quite the challenge to come up with the government's response. Tell us a bit about Mabo to begin with.
Look, I have to say right at the outset that the work on the response was a whole of government exercise led by Paul Keating, who was ultimately magnificent in negotiating with Aboriginal people and leading a just response. But I wrote a book called Taking a Stand that featured the detail of the Mabo decision and its aftermath in some great detail. It's so difficult to summarise it in a few sentences, but the essence of the challenge was essentially to respond to the High Court decision to set up a procedure whereby claims that native title existed could be determined essentially by a tribunal process rather than separate litigation over many, many decades by individual claimants. And that's what the Native Title Act ultimately did. But what people need to remember was that the extraordinary furor, the relentless attacks on the High Court itself in the aftermath of the decision, the incredible attacks on attempts to try and bring a just and sensible resolution through the Native Title Act. You know, just in the last period of 1992, I remember the Western Mining Corporation, Hugh Morgan, CEO, talked about the need to repeal the Racial Discrimination Act. The Institute of Public Affairs talked about the decision having features, and I quote, of Russian communist land holding. The Australian Mining Industry Council said that every mining lease in Australia was at risk. And this just went on and on for much of the next year. But it wasn't 1992 that was the year that made me, but 1993.
And why was that?
Well, that was the year when the debate hotted up. These examples I've just given were in the quiet period in 1992.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
It really got tough in 1993. But what was quite remarkable, I suppose, for me, and I've, you know, kept it a great secret, was that it was also the year in which I met my birth mother as an adopted person. And I have written a book about this, which is called 10 Doors Down. It's coming out next February, which seriously treats adoption issues with the gravity that they deserve. And Australians these days, and particularly women who were born 1980 or afterwards, you know, find it hard to imagine the incredible stigma that single mothers had in the 50s, 60s and going into the 70s. The Canadian singer Joni Mitchell, who went through a similar experience in Canada, said being a single mother was equivalent to having murdered someone. The stigma was so incredible. Mm. So my story kind of tells this wonderful experience of meeting my birth mother, and then goes on to tell the story of how I met my birth father and two brothers and two sisters. And all this happened while I was a federal minister, and I kept it one of the best kept secrets in Parliament House.
Well, not a place known for keeping of secrets.
Indeed.
As you mentioned, you had quite the workload at the time. What was it that made that process begin in 1993?
Well, it was, as you said, the birth of my son. You know, I had thought that until then, in the nature-nurture debate, that nurture was everything, that environment shaped people almost exclusively. And I do think it's an enormous influence. And we all know that the privilege of growing up in favourable circumstances and with love and the support of a family has the most powerful positive effect on people. But when my son was born, he was the first person on the planet that I knew that was biologically related to me. And when I looked down on him, I suddenly thought, it's a bit more complicated than I had thought. And this is only a tiny snippet of the story, but the coincidences were quite amazing, and that's why the book is called 10 Doors Down.
Well, we can all look forward to 10 Doors Down coming out next year. But Robert, we ask our guests on this segment to choose a song that sort of typifies the year that made you. What have you chosen for us?
Well, because the Stolen Generations Inquiry was such an important thing for me a very privileged and humble to have made a contribution to getting that inquiry happening. And so Archie Roach's song, Taking the Children Away, is absolutely and must be my choice.
Well, high praise from a national treasure about a national
Indeed.
Treasure.
Indeed.
here it is. Robert Tickner, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
This story's right, this story's true. I would not tell lies to you, like the promises they did not keep, and how they fenced us in like sheep. Said to us, come take our hand, set us up on mission land, taught us to read, to write and pray. Then they took the children away, took the children away, the children away. Snatched from their mother's breast, said this is for the best, took them away. Welcome and the holy name, said you've got to understand. We'll give to them what you can't give. Teach them how to really live. Teach them how to live their self. Humiliated them instead. Taught them that and taught them this. And others taught them prejudice. You took the children away, the children away. Breaking their mother's heart, caring us all about, took them away. One dark day on Framlingham, came and didn't give a damn. My mother cried, go get their dad. He came running, frightened. Mother's tears were falling down. Dad shaped up and stood his ground. He said, you touch my kids and you fight me. Then they took us from a family, took us away. They took us away. Snatched from our mother's breast, said this is for the best, took us away.
Yes, the wonderful Archie Roach, that is, Took the Children Away, the song chosen by our guest for the year that made me, and what a year it was, Robert Tickner talking there.